Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. Everywhere you look on Earth, you're likely to find animals, and inside and outside every animal, you're likely to find parasites. The appeal of a convenient, safe, warm environment was just too good an opportunity to pass up, and evolution has meant there are all kinds of different creatures living on and even in you. A lot of relatively harmless ones, but many can affect the way that animals behave and even grow. My guest today is Khalil Thurlaway. Khalil has been doing research in the field of immunology or immunoparasitology, drawing on his fascination with the world of parasites and exploring how we can use plant extracts to bolster our own immune systems to fight them against potentially developing a whole new raft of drugs. Welcome, Khalil.
Morning.
It's good to have you on. What you've been doing has actually been a little bit of chemical detective work. So later we're going to try a bit of that out here. And if you want to follow along with us at home, what you're going to need is a red cabbage, some hot water, and a collection of mystery chemicals. So, I mean, what I mean by this is just like go under the sink, pull out a few things, and just we're just going to try them. We're going to try and work out.
Make sure you read the hazard warnings first, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Please be safe.
We're not going to be held responsible.
No, absolutely not. So, Iman, you're here with us today, and you've got a weekly riddle. What have we got today?
I do. So, this week's riddle is: I am an item of jewellery. Change one letter and I am the outer skin of fruit. Change another letter and I am a current of air. Change a further letter and I am an alcoholic drink. Change one final letter and I am a trailing plant. What was I and what have I become? So I'll do that one more time. I am an item of jewellery. Change one letter and I am the outer skin of fruit. Change another letter and I am a current of air. Change a further letter and I am an alcoholic drink. Change one final letter and I am a trailing plant. What was I and what did I become?
Very interesting. If you know the answer, do try and tweet in to @ScienceMixtape and we'll see if anyone gets it. To kick us off, Khalil, you've chosen your first song. You've chosen Pharaoh Monch with Push. Should we just have a listen to that? Let's just kick it off. All right, we're just gonna go straight away with this is Pharaoh Monch with Push.
One day at a time, hold my head so I don't lose my mind. Sometimes you might fall down, but you get back up, get on your journey.
Parasites are the most common form of life on Earth. Scientists believe that over 80% of all living things are parasites. And I think that's what my parents would call me if I didn't get a job and move out.
Well, yeah, my parents think I'm a parasite.
Yeah.
My little brother's definitely a parasite. So we're going to be talking about parasites a little bit later, but Khalil, you actually got your PhD in immunology.
Yeah.
Can you explain what that is?
Well, immunology is the study of your immune system and how it detects and deals with incoming threats, or sometimes how it goes wrong and how it can cause disease as well.
And so specifically for your PhD, you were looking at how that is changed by using plant extracts. What were you doing?
Yeah, so I was looking at a specific family of receptors. So these are molecules on the surfaces of certain immune cells that detect and classify incoming chemicals and bacteria and viruses and stuff like that, so that you can activate exactly the right part of the immune response to defend yourself.
What are these molecules called?
They're called toll-like receptors.
Okay.
And so I was looking in plants to see if we could find new molecules that might either turn up or turn down the activity of various ones of these toll-like receptors. Because if we can do that, then we'd be able to kind of fine-tune the immune system, whether it's being too active or not active enough in certain areas.
Because, I mean, this isn't really new, right? People have used plant extracts to develop drugs in the past. Like, a lot of our really well-known drugs are actually derived from plants, aren't they?
Oh, sure, of course. But I mean, before we invented kind of synthetic chemistry and stuff, all of our medicines came from plants.
Yeah.
So stuff like aspirin and morphine and stuff like that, they're really old medicines that have just been kind of taken into the industrial age. And we're still, you know, we're still discovering new medicines from stuff like plants and fungi and stuff. For example, artemisinin, which is a really good anti-malarial drug, and ivermectin, which is from soil bacteria. That's an anti-parasite drug. That really, they've made big differences to the developing world, especially. And yeah, they've been synthesized from natural sources.
So how did you get hold of the extracts that you were looking at?
Well, the plants were Malaysian rainforest plants, but unfortunately, I didn't actually get a chance to go out and collect them in the field.
That's a shame.
Yeah, I had a collaborator in Malaysia who sent me basically a dried extract. So they'd get the plants and then they would extract all the soluble molecules in either alcohol or acetate, and then they'd basically freeze dry the solvent away, and I'd be left with this kind of hard paste, which was all the molecules that had been in that plant that could be dissolved in that solvent.
Right, so the solvent would like dissolve them out of the plant, and then you just got rid of the solvent and you're left with just the stuff that comes from the plant.
Yeah, and it was kind of a very crude mixture of loads and loads and loads and loads of different unidentified molecules.
Right, and so you then had to begin a process of kind of identifying them, or did you start off by just seeing if they made a difference? How did you start, how did you go about kind of figuring out whether any of these chemicals that can actually affect the immune system?
Oh, yeah, like you said, I first started off by just seeing if any of these plant extracts would do anything to any of the toll-like receptors. So I was growing different batches of human cells which had different combinations of these toll-like receptors on them. And then I would treat them with these plant extracts and see whether their immune activity increased or decreased.
Right. So just to see if there's any difference with these plant extracts around.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's no point trying to classify the chemicals within this complex mixture if none of them do anything.
Yeah, I suppose that's logical, right? So then, after you found some that did do something, and then what was the process?
So once I'd identified some of the plant extracts which had either stimulatory or inhibitory activity on some of these receptors, the next step was to try and identify what it was in these plant extracts, what molecules it was. So first of all, a good way of getting rid of loads of the extraneous ones that I don't need was classifying the molecules by size.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I can identify a size window of, you know, let's say 10 to 30 kilodaltons or whatever.
So a kilodalton is just like a measure of how many atoms there are in a molecule.
Yeah, it's a measure of kind of how heavy a single molecule of something is. And so if I could identify a size window, then I could instantly eliminate everything outside that window, so that cuts down loads and loads and loads of work. So I classified it by size, and then we were trying to look at what types of molecules these were. So there are various treatments that we could do to these purified extracts that would disable certain types of molecules. So then if the activity stopped after this treatment, I knew that it was that type of molecule.
Right, so there's kind of like this bit of detective work, you're like figuring out, oh wait, which ones, and then I allocate them into size. Well, I know it, the one that's active is probably around this size. And this is kind of how people have done research in drugs for a long time, and how they're still doing it, even with other things, you know.
Sure.
Is to just try loads of things to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, there are other approaches as well that people use. For example, they can have very kind of targeted drug development, rather than, because what I was doing was screening natural products. So there was a huge library of molecules, and I was just trying to see if any of them worked. But sometimes, if you know the exact, for example, the exact structure of the part of the specific molecule that you're looking to target, then you can do a kind of more designed approach rather than just looking out in nature.
You build your molecule around what you already know kind of works.
Yeah, it's coming at it from the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And both directions have yielded some really great research and interesting drugs and really valuable drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So you were looking at these, I'm interested in these toll-like receptors, and What do they do in the body? Why is it so important to be able to manipulate them?
Oh, because they're kind of your frontline detection receptors on your immune system. So if you imagine your immune system is kind of like your body's military, these receptors, they're the kind of early warning system. They will, that each of them recognizes certain different groups of molecular patterns that are common to different groups of pathogens, disease-causing organisms. So one of them, for example, recognizes the protein that makes up the tail on a swimming bacterium. Or right, okay. Another one recognizes certain types of RNA that are only really present in viruses.
Mm-hmm. So this is like your body's way of like figuring out whether something's a virus or not, or a pathogen.
What little subgroup of viruses or what little subgroup of bacteria. Because your immune system is really, really complex and it has all these different signaling pathways and different kind of end effects that it can do. It's not just turn on, turn off. It's really, really complex. And so you need to balance all these kind of signaling pathways and all of these communication channels to get the right effect in the end. And if you have an imbalance in one part of this complex web, it can kind of have far-reaching knock-on effects.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that we kind of have this understanding of this very complicated thing that is our immune system, and yet we're able to change it with things that you found that, which are as simple as plant extracts.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Pretty amazing. So I think we'll move on to your next song. You've chosen KZ Elephant, Ain't No Rest for the Wicked. Why did you choose this one?
So the songs that I've chosen today kind of have a bit of a theme. They kind of, each of them looks at a different point in the kind of PhD journey. Doing a PhD is a long, hard slog, and there are ups and downs. So that first track, Push, you know, it's all about determination and kind of pushing through.
Yeah.
And when you start a PhD, you're full of optimism and you're like, yeah, I'm going to nail this. Yeah. I'm going to do the best PhD thesis anyone's ever seen.
And so this second song, what's this one about?
This next one's called Ain't No Rest for the Wicked, because it soon becomes apparent that optimism and determination are great, but they're nothing without sweat and long days and late nights and kind of
some tears. Yeah. Some crying.
Well, here we go. Long days and late nights.
I was walking down the street when out the corner of my eye I saw a pretty little thing approaching me. She said, I never seen a man who looks so all alone. Or could you use a little company? If you pay the right price, your evening will be nice and you can go and send me on my way. I said, you're such a sweet young thing, why you do this to yourself? She looked at me and this is what she said. Oh, there ain't no rest for the wicked.
Microscopic single-celled protozoans make up about 90% of all parasitic infections in the US.
There's a lot smaller than I thought. I'm when I think of parasites, I'm imagining these like massive tapeworms and stuff like that.
Well, parasites will range for everything from the microscopic up to stuff that can be, you know, tens of feet long.
So what's the general like definition of a parasite?
It's not actually very well defined, because you know there are some people who would say, for example, a virus is a parasite or something, or you know, but we wouldn't normally tend to classify it as that. It tends to be an organism which entirely depends on another organism for its, you know, food and reproduction and stuff. But
the host. Okay.
But the host organism doesn't benefit, actually, you know, pays a price for having this parasite.
Right. So it's not like a symbiotic thing.
No.
Yeah.
So for example, in your gut, you've got, you know, billions and billions and billions of bacteria living there. Mm. And they're fine. We call them commensals or symbiotes.
Right. Yeah. I think a bit later you're going to give us a rundown on your favorite parasite. But right now
we've got a couple of things I can think of.
Yeah.
So we were talking a bit before that a lot of your research was kind of this chemistry detective work. So we're going to do a little experiment here in the studio. And so to join us, what you're going to need to do is take some red cabbage. And you chop the cabbage up very finely and then get some hot water and pour the hot water. So put the cabbage in like a saucepan or something. Pour the hot water into the cabbage. I used about half a red cabbage and about half a litre of hot water. let it rest for a few minutes, and then sieve the mixture so that you just have the liquid and all of the bits of cabbage are left over. And what you'd be left with is this kind of purpley liquid.
It's a lovely colour.
Yeah, it's really lovely. And then very much in a Blue Peter fashion, I've prepared some earlier, which is now in this lovely thermos flask, which is in the studio. And what I'm going to do is we've then got four substances. And what we're going to get Khalil to do is add our cabbage water to each of the four substances. And we don't really... Well, I know what they are, but no one else does. So we're just going to just try it and see what happens. So if you want to just describe what you're doing, Khalil, while you're doing it.
So I'm opening the thermos, and I'm going to add a little bit of the cabbage indicator to the first cup, taking a lot of care not to get it on my clothes because this wonderful purple will stain. So, just adding it to the first cup.
Oh, it is a lovely colour.
Yeah, so the liquid that came out of the flask was a kind of purple.
It's like a dark violet. All, yeah, dark. Lovely.
But it's gone into the cup and it's turned this kind of pinky, pink red.
Yeah, of kind of like fuchsia.
Fuchsia, that's a great one. All right, so cup one has turned fuchsia, right? And let's try...
That's a highly scientific term.
It's a highly scientific term. Let's try it, cup two, and see what happens there.
Okay, so... Adding to cup two.
Oh.
So I've added some of the indicator to the second cup, and instead of mixing with the liquid, it's kind of formed a layer that's
gloopy layer
on top.
So it's kind
and
of
it
the
stayed
same
that
colour.
Same purple.
Yeah, it stayed that same purple. I'm just going to give it a little bit of a chemist's shake here.
Oh, it's starting to mix now.
It's starting to. It's
kinda, staying purple.
It's staying purple. It's maybe a little bit lighter, but I guess that's it. And now we'll try cup three.
Cup number three.
So cup number three is...
It's mixed very well. No shaking required, but it stayed it's been more diluted, but it stayed the same type of purple as it was before.
Yeah. All right. So we started off with our first cup, which has gone a kind of red. And actually now the second cup, now that you look at it, comparing it to the third, it's kind of... It's a little bit redder.
It definitely is, yeah.
Now but it's not quite as deep purple. And now we'll go on to cup four. And so adding a little bit to cup
the
four.
The final cup.
Oh,
that's great. As soon as the indicator has hit the solution, it's mixed and turned a lovely kind of cobalt blue.
Yeah, look at these. These are great words for describing these colours here. So,
I was raised by an artist.
All right, so we've got red, a kind of reddy purple, and a blue. What are we seeing here, Khalil?
So this is an example of an indicator, which is a chemical that changes colour at different levels of pH. So pH is a way we measure acidity or alkalinity. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a measure of how many hydrogen ions there are in the solution. So an acid, when it goes into a water solution, it will release hydrogen ions into the water. And it's those hydrogen ions, when they react with stuff, that's how you notice something is acidic. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's what would have turned the indicator red.
Right.
So cup number one would have been acidic.
And I actually, in cup number one, it was lemon juice.
Ah!
So that's why, so lemon juice.
Glad that went to plan.
Exactly, yeah. We've definitely got them the right way around. There was no mixing up of the cups. And then, on the other side, there's this kind of bluey one. What's happening there?
So that will have been an alkali solution of some kind. And alkalis do the opposite. They take in any... hydrogen ions that are floating in the solution. So that's why they're called proton acceptors. Mm-hmm. We call acids proton donors because a hydrogen ion is just a single proton. So they donate protons to the water. Whereas alkalis are proton acceptors. If there's any protons flying around, then they will take them and react with them.
Brilliant. Okay, well, so some of this... You actually did reactions to this... during your work that were quite similar, right? You're making these kind of measurements. They're actually still useful in the lab.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Have a really pretty lab bench with all those different colours.
One of the great things about doing work in a lab is that some of the colours are great. For example, you know, when I was growing these cells, sometimes I'd grow them in these what we call 96 well plates. So they're like a plastic flat rectangular plate with 96 mm-hmm. tiny little wells in them. And you'd grow the cells in there, and there'd be an indicator in the medium you're growing them in. And so as they use up a lot of the nutrients in the medium, they would start to acidify the medium and the colour would change. And so you'd have this lovely range of like peaches and pinks and yellows. That was pretty nice.
It's nice. It's one of these special things that happens in a chemistry or biology lab. You see all these magnificent colours. So Cleo, let's move on to your third song. You've chosen The Eels and Mr. E's Beautiful Blues. Why did you choose this?
Two reasons. One, because the Cage the Elephant track always reminds me of this song, because there's a lyric in this song where it says, the elephant won't forget what it's like inside its cage. But also because, you know, yes, you have to push, and yes, there's no rest for the wicked, and you're working a lot, but there are really lovely moments during a PhD. It can be very stressful, but you know, there's lots of like great companionship, and you know, when an experiment works, you're just goddamn right, it's a beautiful day. And so that's that's what this song reminds me of.
It is estimated that over 50 million children in America are infected with worm parasites, but only a small number of those are detected or reported.
Ugh.
Yeah, gross.
Well,
that's how good parasites are at hiding.
I see, exactly. So, Kelly,
which makes them really good parasites if they manage to go undetected.
Yeah, I mean,
very effective.
Why cause trouble if you can just kind of hide and mooch off them?
Steal food, live in your host, have a great time.
Exactly. If your landlord doesn't manage to kick you out. It's fine.
Exactly. So, Khalil, your research was in a immunoparasitology group, right? And so why did you choose to start doing research on parasites?
I've always loved parasites. That sounds bad.
That does sound a little weird, yeah.
No, because they just have this totally different kind of subversive approach to life's problems. You know, most organisms that are kind of free living, they've got to find shelter, they've got to worry about finding food, finding a mate. You know, what if it rains, what if it gets cold? For a parasite, they skip most of those problems. Yeah. Once they've found a host, then those problems are all taken care of.
Yeah, like find someone who's doing all of that successfully and just live.
Exactly. It's a lovely warm environment, there's food, you know, and then other members of your species will parasitize the same host often, and so like you'll get mates just arrive in. But then, like I said, the landlord always wants to kick you out, and so if he catches you, he'll kill you and all your family.
Yeah, it's pretty.
Suddenly became much less desirable.
I think living in London's bad. So do you have a favorite parasite?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Which one's that?
It's called Ribeiroia.
And
it's a small type of flatworm, a kind of fluke. And its main host, what we call the principal host, is a heron. So the adults live and reproduce in the gut of a heron or another kind of wading bird.
Mm.
And the eggs come out in the bird's poo. And they hatch in the water, and they hatch into the first larval stage, which is kind of like a... looks like a little microscopic hairy grape, and that swims around looking for the next host, and that is a type of water snail, and it burrows into the water snail, and it burrows into the snail's gonads and sterilizes it.
Oh God!
So and there it so the snail isn't putting any energy into reproducing, so the parasite can use more energy to multiply and to mature into the second larval stage. And so when it's divided more and matured into the second stage, they burst out. And these are little kind of, they look kind of like a microscopic tadpole, but with a little forked tail. Okay. They look really alien. And they swim around and they find an actual tadpole. And they burrow in through the soft skin and they infect the limb buds. So these are the areas of the tadpole which will then go on to develop into legs.
Mm.
And so when the tadpole develops into an adult frog, its limb buds are all mashed up from these parasites living and breeding there. And so the legs that do grow, sometimes you'll have like three stunted legs sticking out of one hip, another missing leg.
Oh, God.
And these are really very like grotesque deformities.
And the parasite is actually affecting the way that the frog is growing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of changing its behavior to benefit it. Why does it benefit?
And the cleverest part is the fact that these frogs are so deformed means that they can't swim or hop very effectively. So they're really easy targets for birds. And so they end up in the bird's stomach.
That's actually
And the
brilliant.
Life cycle continues.
That is fascinating. I mean, that is amazing. How does that evolve, right? Because it relies on the concurrent evolution of the parasite, the snails, the frogs, and the birds.
It's all a kind of an arms race. So what, you know, one of the kind of biggest drivers of evolution over, you know, because it's such a long relationship, is the kind of host parasite or the host pathogen relationship, because the stakes are really high for both, for everyone concerned.
Yeah.
And so the host is always trying to find, you know, ways to evolve defenses, and then the parasite is always finding little kind of Achilles heels and little ways around the defenses.
Wow, it is like this arms race.
I'm actually a little bit mind blown. That's brilliant.
Well, you should definitely Google images of Ribeiroia frogs. They are grotesque.
Wow. Yeah, definitely do that. I don't know. There's just something kind of weird about a parasite that makes us feel a bit uncomfortable. Like, I don't really like the idea of one living inside. I mean, why do you think that is? Is it just like a...
Well, it's an evolved response we have, because obviously parasites harm us, you know, depending on which parasite it is. It could be really bad harm or just mooching off us. But evolutionarily, we've evolved some of these kind of instincts of disgust to keep us away from parasites and germs and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know...
That's why things smell bad.
And that's why we find poo disgusting.
Yeah, I mean, and funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but you know, if you have any, gut parasites, their eggs will be in your poo.
Right, yeah.
And so... We avoid poo because it's a great way to transmit diseases by handling poo.
Yeah, it definitely is. So, Khalil, we're going to move on to your fourth song. You've chosen I'll Fly Away by Gillian Welch and Alison Krauss. You're saying that all of your songs were kind of linked together through the journey of your PhD. What was this one about? And what stage in the journey are we at?
This was a bit of a hard time PhD-wise. There always comes a point where you think that, you know, because it's a long period, it's like 4 years.
Yeah.
There comes a point where you think it's going to be never ending and you can't see, you know, you've lost the initial impetus and the kind of optimism, and there's yet to be a light at the end of the tunnel, and you're not getting any data, and you're starting to doubt yourself, and you worry whether you're actually smart enough to do it, or, you know, sometimes people even consider dropping out.
Yeah.
And so, this song was a song that helped me remember that, you know, nothing is forever. It's all going to end someday. Because this song is actually, you know, the instrumental is really kind of upbeat, but the lyrics are tragic. It's about someone who's wishing, like, you know, looking forward to death so that they'll fly away.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I wasn't wishing for death, but I was quite looking forward to flying away.
to the next step. So here is I'll Fly Away by Gillian Welch and Alison Krauss.
I'll fly away to that home.
There are over 30,000 species of mites, and they live almost everywhere. The earliest mite fossil dates to about 400 million years ago.
News. Sushi parasites on the rise.
Fish study on ocean plastics cast into doubt.
36 million year old fossil discovery is missing link in whale evolution.
Homo naledi is younger than expected.
New dinosaur discovery named Zool, Destroyer of Shins.
That is so good. From Ghostbusters.
Yep.
Yeah, all right. So what's this new dinosaur, Destroyer of Shins?
So they've recently discovered a new species of ankylosaur. So ankylosaurs were quite squat dinosaurs with bony, spiky faces and armor on their backs. And on their tail, they had a big, heavy bone club, which they would swing in self-defense.
Yeah.
So they called this dinosaur Zool, Destroyer of Shins, because its face looked like Zool from the original Ghostbusters film.
Right, okay.
And Destroyer of Shins, for obvious reasons.
And you know, I would, you know, maybe ankles, shins, they're all in the same sort of area, right?
Yeah.
Ankylosaur? I don't know. Is that where the name comes from? Maybe it's a... You know,
there's definitely a Greek origin
ankles.
Somewhere yeah. there. I think you've got the Latin name.
So the Latin name for it is Zool cruvistator, which translates to
Destroyer of Shins.
Destroyer of Shins, which is great. I, going with our parasite theme, actually saw that there was a report in the British Medical Journal, which is only like a couple of days ago, about it described the infection of a Spanish man by a nematode, a parasite, and it's called anisakisis. And it was like worms giving him intestinal pain, vomiting, and the report concluded that he actually might have contracted the parasite from eating sushi. So that was what they like asked him loads of questions. He was like, oh yeah, I had sushi, and apparently these parasites have been on the rise in Japan, and they're now happening more in Western countries because people are eating uncooked fish. And actually this particular parasite didn't really respond to any drugs, which is obviously what your research was eventually looking into, to try and actually develop new drugs that might be able to affect these. But they managed to get it out by using a tiny little net on the end
adorable.
Of an endoscope.
I love that. Yeah, sweeping about, just trying to find.
Down
old school. Just
love
yeah.
that.
So apparently, if you want to eat sushi, you should freeze your fish for a few days at least minus 15 degrees, and then all the parasites are gone. And it's not really fresh sushi anymore, but maybe you can still
enjoy it. Parasite-free.
But parasite-free, yeah. And so there was some missing whale found, right? Is this new?
How do you lose a whale?
I think it was quite an old whale. It's been dead a while.
The missing link in whale evolution.
Right, okay.
So I'm about to butcher some Latin, but the... Oh, God. Mysticodon selenensis?
Yeah, sounds good.
That one?
Are you convinced me?
Is found in Peru and is the oldest known cousin of the modern baleen whales. And it gives us some really new insights into kind of the evolutionary process, and particularly the formation of the skull and the jaw and the teeth and how they used to feed, because they would use this kind of threaded kind of net is the only way that I can describe it to catch their fish.
Right.
But they also use suckers as well. And the suckers, researchers think, shows that the prey that they were eating was much larger than just fishing out, which whales now do and just eat kind of plankton.
Yeah, because like these huge whales that just eat tiny little animals.
So they think that this whale shows that whales would have been eating much larger prey. And the, yeah, as I said, the kind of tooth, which comes from the Greek for moustache.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Just a nugget there.
All these come from the from the skulls of the whales, right? You know,
yeah.
Does a whale have a moustache? Well,
so it's kind of like helping us to kind of map out the evolutionary process. So.
Yeah, so I actually found something similar to do with evolution, but not of whales, but of humans. And... So researchers have now dated a hominid, which is called Homo naledi, and they found it in a cave system in South Africa, and they found that it was only a few hundred thousand years old, which means that it existed around the same time as our own species, Homo sapien, was evolving. And I think this is amazing, and they said that possibly it actually evolved from a larger brained hominid, which is kind of going against the grain of the conventional wisdom. Most people think that, you know, members of the genus Homo, our you know, ancestors and relatives, just evolved over time to get bigger brains. And this is an example of maybe that not happening. But I just think it's amazing to think of, you know, all of these different apes, essentially what we are, you know, all could all have been existing at the same time. And actually, we're the only species that managed to survive.
And there is some evidence of interbreeding between different Homo species as well. So Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, for example. So especially in your toll-like receptor genes, actually, there are some versions of the toll-like receptor genes which are thought to come from Neanderthal.
That's cool.
Right. Wow. Linking it back to the theme is great. So, Khalil, we're going to have to move on, or we're going to run out of time, but you've got your fifth song, which is Scrappy by Wookie. Why did you choose that one? What stage are we at in the PhD?
This is deep into the writing up stage, and you know, this is really when you're hitting the wall in terms of, you know, marathon runner analogies. And this song, I've always loved it, and it's so powerfully upbeat that it was something I used to just kind of like, you know, cheer myself up when things were getting a bit hard.
Allegedly, the largest human parasite ever to be extracted from the body of a human being was a 37-foot tapeworm. On September 5th, 2001, doctors extracted the monster worm from Sally Mae Wallace's mouth.
Whoa.
Gross.
Wow. 37
gross.
Feet. That is, see,
yeah,
see,
you need
when I think
some
of a parasite,
net for that.
Yeah, that's what I think of when I think of a parasite. So, Khalil, you've actually moved away from research a bit now. You know, PhD was, you know, something that you
intense.
Did, and I'm sure you enjoyed at times, but, you know, you wanted to fly away. So what are you doing now?
I work at the Science Museum at the moment. I'm in the Contemporary Science team there, and I put together events and exhibitions to bring the contemporary side of science to the public. Because the museum, we've got lots of old artifacts, like, you know, Stevenson's rocket and loads of, like, old planes and stuff like that. But, you know, the contemporary research side of stuff is also really important. It's important to keep people engaged in that.
Yeah, and so you were involved with this Robots Revealed exhibition that went on recently. What was that? What was involved there?
So at the moment, we've got our big robots exhibition in the museum, and that's kind of, it explores the relationship between humans and humanoid automata and robots over the past few hundred years. But we wanted to also have some events running alongside the exhibition, which were kind of more research focused. So what I did is I got some, you know, robotics research groups from around the country to come to the museum with their robots, and kind of they'd do demos in the museum and have conversations with the public. We really wanted it to be like a two-way conversation rather than just a show or a lecture.
Yeah, I think it's you know, there is this great thing about when you can establish a kind of dialogue rather than just showing everybody, and actually you end up with inspiring the science and, you know, getting people into it, and so it really feeds back, and it's very important for that to happen.
It's very, very important to show that science is for everyone and that everyone has the ability to engage with it.
Definitely, and especially because we get such a varied audience in the museum, you know, young, old, boy, girl, all sorts of different backgrounds and stuff. So we really get a really wide reach, and especially with robotics as well, and kind of engineering in general. There's still a lot of work trying to get girls into it.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and science in general has a bit of a male skew in terms of, you know,
getting up. It's significant, you know, yeah. And but, trying to get women.
But engineering and robotics is especially bad. It's all like 9% female or something.
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, anything you can do to get women into science is brilliant.
And that's why it was great at these events. You know, we'd have these brilliant male and female roboticists, and, you know, all these little kids would be coming up to them and seeing that, you know, anyone can be a roboticist. You just have to, like, want to and try and get into it.
Representation is so important for, like, a young girl to see that a woman's there and, you know, I can be this. Yeah, very, very important.
Definitely. So, Khalil, thanks so much, and continue doing that work in the Science Museum. Thanks so much for coming in. But before we go, we have time to answer our riddle.
Oh, yes.
So, let's hear it one more time, and then we'll try and figure it out.
Okay. So, this week's riddle was, I'm an item of jewellery. Change one letter, and I am the outer skin of fruit. Change another letter, and I am a current of air. Change a further letter, and I am an alcoholic drink. Change one final letter and I am a trailing plant. What was I and what did I become? So congratulations to Miriam and Ben, who both got it right and tweeted in. The item of jewellery... Oh, sorry.
I got Vine at the end, okay, but I didn't get the beginning. I was lost. I don't know what...
Well, so I'll review the answer. The item of jewellery is a ring. Changing one letter and you get rind. Changing another letter, you get wind for the current of air. Changing a further letter, you get wine for the alcoholic drink. And changing the last letter, you get vine for your trailing plant.
Which is kind of related to wine, because grapes grow on vines.
There we go.
Exactly, it's all themed here. So, Khalil, thank you so much for coming in. Thanks. How can people get in contact with you? Social media or
So, like? On Twitter, my handle is @KinkoTheMonkey.
That's a solid handle. Yeah.
And that you know, that's just kind of... stream of consciousness of science, lefty politics and music and occasional bits of martial arts.
Brilliant. We didn't get to the martial arts, but maybe you'll find it on Twitter. And you can get in touch with us on @ScienceMixtape, sweet tweet, follow, like. If you'd like to listen to the shows again, it will go up on Mixcloud, or you can download a podcast version on iTunes or however you get hold of it. We're going to finish with your last song, Khalil, which is The Skints with This Town.
So this is the coming home track. I grew up in London, down in Brixton, and coming back from Nottingham after my PhD was just absolutely blissful.
Brilliant.
Not writing a thesis and being back home.
Mm. Here we go. Welcome home. So thanks, guys, and goodbye.
London city I was born in, and you know I love this town, but I can't pick up when she's calling.
So rhythm it was fun of me to the place that raised me, gave me the up and down that develop and shape me, give me a rundown.